Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up, we will talk more about the effects to take effect immediately with respect to health care reform. What will come down the pike first that might affect you? We'll talk about that in a little while. But now that health reform is giving a major victory to President Obama, the other two main planks of his long-term economic growth program remain to be passed. We talked Friday about his education reform bill just introduced. And then there is energy, at the center of which is cap and trade, intended to protect the planet from global warming and spur a new generation of energy technology growth and energy independence. This week, we'll get two different views of cap and trade and its potential effects on the world's poor, in addition to the United States as a nation, from two contrasting giants in their fields. On Wednesday, Jeffrey Sachs from the Earth Institute will be here. Right now, we'll talk to Bjørn Lomborg, former Greenpeace activist, now a professor at the Copenhagen Business School, and author of the books Cool It and The Skeptical Environmentalist. Cool It is being made into a movie for release later this year, we understand, by a Sundance-winning filmmaker. And despite its skeptical nature, that book has been named by Cambridge University as one of the 50 all-time books on sustainability, along with things like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed. So Bjørn Lomborg, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Brian, it's good to be here.
First, if I understand your writings correctly, you're not a global warming denier. You believe the Earth could likely warm close to 5 degrees Fahrenheit this century and that warming is 50 to 100% man-made. Fair starting point?
Absolutely, and thank you very much. No, I'm not skeptical about global warming. I'm skeptical about how we tackle it because, quite frankly, we are not.
Well, your big disagreement with most environmentalists and progressive policymakers, as I read your stuff, is that you think their cost-benefit analysis tends to be wrong, especially with respect to the world's poor, correct?
Yes. Fundamentally, we're all talking about cutting carbon emissions and preferably cutting it right now. It makes us feel like we're really doing something, but the fundamental problem is it's both fairly costly and it's not happening, and even if it was, it wouldn't do very much good to tackle global warming. So I'm simply trying to point out when you do the economic analysis, as you alluded to, if you, for instance, do the Kyoto Protocol or something along those lines, for instance, the Waxman-Markey bill for the entire world or for all the industrialized
world. That's the cap-and-trade bill.
Cap-and-trade. You will essentially be spending, for every dollar, you will only avoid perhaps 35 or even less cents of climate damage for every dollar spent. That's a bad deal. That's a bad way to help the poor.
And I'm sure Jeffrey Sachs will have other numbers on Wednesday, but you're concerned about the negative impact of this economic growth, or the negative impact on economic growth, I should say, specifically on the developing world. You want to talk about that?
Well, because honestly, we are pretty rich. Of course, we could afford to lose that amount of money. But I'm actually more concerned about the way that this doesn't actually deal with global warming. And, of course, it doesn't deal with the immediate problems of the poor. So let's take those two in sequence. If we want to do something about climate change, it's not enough that some rich, well-meaning Westerners cut a little bit of their CO2. It makes us feel good, but ultimately it won't do very much to deal with climate change. To do that, we need to get the Chinese and the Indians to cut as well. And we will only do that if we get technology that makes it so cheap to cut that everybody wants to. So instead of trying to put up inefficient solar panels and windmills now, we should invest a lot more in research and development of green energy technology so that they become so cheap that everyone wants to put them up.
So you're for a lot of government spending on green energy technology?
Yes. But the point is, you should be spending it on making better technology available for the future rather than, as we almost exclusively do right now, putting up inefficient technology now. But also, if I could just briefly address the issue of the world's poor, obviously, the world's poor is going to be hit the worst with global warming in 100 years. But let's just remember, the world's poor are pretty bad off right now, and they're dealing with lots of other very, very simply solvable problems like lack of clean drinking water, lack of electricity, and of course, lack of food, and easily curable infectious diseases. Why are we not focusing, if we care about them, on that right now? And of course, Jeff will also say, well, we should do that. But we're not doing that either very well. So I'm saying let's spend on the world's poor right now more, and let's spend more on research and development into green energy.
So in a world of limited resources, because we can't spend everything on everything, you're saying it's going to help the poor countries a lot and the public health in the poor countries a lot more to spend on things like malaria netting, say, than to spend so much on global warming, which is going to make it more difficult to take care of those infrastructure needs like anti-malaria and clean water supplies and things like that.
Yeah, just to give you a sense, we went out and I think every news outlet did this, talked to poor people around the world and talked about the problems with global warming. And of course, it's going to be a significant problem for them. But we also asked these poor people all around the world, for instance, this woman in Kenya living on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, and said, what else is a problem for you? And of course, then suddenly she talked about all these other things. And she said, you know, when my kids are going to bed hungry tonight, I don't think global warming is going to be my main concern. And that's important to recognize that, yes, we need to fix climate change, but we need to fix it smartly because, quite frankly, she has more important priorities right now.
There, on your cap and trade analysis about investing in the technology to replace the current carbon-producing technology first, there is a chicken and egg question here, isn't there? Because the proponents of cap and trade or carbon tax would say, look, if you say this kind of pollution is against the law past a certain point and you place a limit on it, then you're going to force the technological change. The technological change will come from innovation that sees a market, and the cap and trade will produce the incentives to create that market. In a way that throwing open-ended research dollars at the problem may not.
That's exactly their argument. But unfortunately, the data actually proves them wrong for two reasons. If you put up a cap-and-trade limit, you're essentially saying you can't pollute more than this. But what do people do? Well, they do the pretty obvious thing. They switch over to what's the cheapest alternative. Very often, that is switched to gas instead of coal, which is what we've seen in Europe. And then you start buying somewhat dodgy emittance allowances, for instance, China. It does not actually increase research and development. Actually, when you look at the data from the International Energy Agency, the only one that we really have that looks across the world, they tell us that investment in research and development in green energy technology has been declining since the early 1980s, and it has not picked up in Europe, which is the only place where we've actually accepted and done the Kyoto Protocol, for very obvious reasons. If you want to cut in 10 years, you don't worry about making technology available for in 20 or 40 years. You worry about finding, you know, the easy substitutes that you can do right now.
Did Europe meet its Kyoto goals? Because the Kyoto period actually ends this year, right? And emissions were supposed to have been cut, I think, what was it, 7% over 1990 levels? Do I have that right?
It's supposed to end in 2012. And Europe will probably just make its limits, but only because of a financial crisis and because we bought quite a few emit permits from China.
But that means that total emissions will actually be going down. It's not just a cut in the rate of growth?
Well, they'll be going down slightly in Europe. But remember, that's also because we, for instance, took up Eastern Europe. Germany got reunified with Eastern Europe, which had a lot of permits left over. But actually, just to give you a sense of proportion, the emissions, if they were 100 in 1990, then by 2012, we expected them to be at 142.7. Now, if the Kyoto Protocol had worked perfectly, it would have been 133 instead. But in reality, Kyoto Protocol probably means we end up at 142.2. We've done virtually no good over the last 18 years of debate and, you know, all these international meetings. I would imagine we could have done better.
And in your opinion, with a hobbling of the European economy in pursuit of Kyoto goals?
No, look, let's be honest. The Kyoto goals are not going to drive anyone to the poorhouse. It's a poor use of resources. If we want to tackle global warming, we can do a lot better. But I think it's just as important to say the other argument, you know, oh, this is going to hobble all the economies and we'll never be able to regain. No, that's not true either. This is simply a question of saying, do we want to do something that just looks good, that makes us feel good, that costs us quite a bit of money and does no good? I would suggest, no. Shouldn't we actually try to do something that'll really help global warming?
Bjorn Lomborg, my guest on WNYC, former Greenpeace activist, author of the books Cool It and The Skeptical Environmentalist, professor at the Copenhagen School of Business. The global warming, let's say people like Al Gore are frustrated with you. Is that fair to say?
Well, yes. And I honestly think it's strange because I think both Al Gore and I and most other people, certainly also Jeff, wants us to find a way to have a zero carbon future. But fundamentally, I think they have latched on to the wrong strategy, namely cut carbon emissions right now. It's been failing since 1992 in Rio. And yet we keep, you know, we went to Copenhagen last year and, oh, surprise, it failed again. And now everybody's saying, well, now we'll go to Cancun this fall and maybe we'll try there or maybe in South Africa next year. At some point, we got to learn this is not working. The second part is the amount of scare tactics that has been out there, you know, telling this is the end of the world. Al Gore just had an op-ed in New York Times where he was essentially saying this is the end of civilization as we know it. You can scare people for some time, but because global warming is a 50 to 100 year proposal, you can't scare people for 50 to 100 years. And we're seeing the problem now that people are being turned off from global warming. We see a drop in concern of global warming everywhere. And I think that's just as scary as we've been over-worried over the last 5 to 10 years and still done nothing. We might end up being under-worried. What we need is a smarter way to tackle global warming, and that is investing in research and development of green energy.
On your cost-benefit analyses with respect to the economy, some of your critics say that you don't take into account long-term hits to economic growth if warming is allowed to go full speed ahead in the name of short-term growth. Do you address the longer-term economy?
Oh, absolutely. It's important to say this is not me. I asked some of the world's top climate economists, 28 of them, to look at all the different places where we can do the most good to tackle climate change. We had 3 Nobel laureates and some of the world's top economists rank all of these. But what they basically said was just trying to cut carbon emissions, as Waxman, Markey, and many others are pretending, even at a very high rate, even if you do it very smartly, for every dollar spent, you'll only avoid about 2 cents of climate damage. If you, on the other hand, invest it in clean energy research and development, for every dollar spent, you'll avoid about $11 of climate damage. It's simply 500 times better. That, I think, is the basic message. And, of course, they do take into account the impacts on long-term economic growth, which is about 2 to 5% of GDP.
And a critique of your positions on Salon.com said your cost-benefit analyses are based on your moderate warming scenario of 4.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Why not try to mitigate to a safer level, a few more degrees, which is still in the realm of possibility, which would mean more controls now, even if in exchange for some immediate economic growth sacrifice?
Yeah. And actually, we did that study. Richard Tall, one of the world's leading climate economists, ran all the main models that we have from the Stanford Energy Modeling Forum to achieve the 2 degrees centigrade limit, which is what everybody has signed up to. We're going to limit the temperature rise by 2 degrees centigrade, or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, indefinitely. Now, even if you did this smartly, the cost by the end of the century would be $40 trillion a year. Now, that's just not going to happen. Nobody's actually going to sign up to this. So my question is really, why do we keep talking about something that everyone knows is not going to happen instead of doing cheaper, more effective, and ultimately much more likely to happen policies like investing dramatically more in research and development? The Economist came out and said, let's spend 0.2% of GDP or $100 billion a year on research and development.
Do you think the seeds of the new technologies are out there today?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, in the film, we've gone out to talk to so many of these different people working with all these wondrous technologies. And in many ways, you can say this film that's coming out, The Cooler, is the first positive or optimistic film about global warming because there are a lot of possible solutions. They're not all going to work.
What are you most optimistic about?
Well, listen, Brian, I think it would be wrong for me to say what is going to be the winner because I don't think any of us know. But just to give you a sense of proportion, if we use the current effectivity of solar panels right now, we could cover the entire global energy demand by putting out solar panels on an area of the equivalent of about 2.6% of the area of the Sahara. Now, of course, we're not going to do that, partly because it wouldn't be where we want it, and also because it'd be incredibly expensive right now. But it shows you we need actually very, very little. What we do need is to have solar panels much cheaper and deal with the storage technology.
Bjørn Lomborg, professor at the Copenhagen Business School, author of the Skeptical Environmentalist from about a decade ago, more recently Cool It, which is now being made into a movie. You have a release date?
Hopefully for Toronto in September.
And you have a question for Jeffrey Sachs that I can throw to him on Wednesday that you can ask in 15 seconds?
Jeff and I have debated this for a long time, and I think we know each other's positions. I think he's a smart guy, but fundamentally the problem is, do we want to do smart technologies? That is what the economists tell us, invest in research and development, or do we want to focus on cutting carbon emissions, which is going to be very expensive?
Bjørn Lomborg, thank you for coming into our studios.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC.